Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's November 27th. I'm looking at the syllabus, the schedule in the syllabus, and I see that we should be finishing up Chapter 14, but we're just going to start Chapter 14 today. I realize that. Oh, the screens aren't on. Let's see, let's get that going. I think they're going to come on. But you have your syllabus with you. And so we're supposed to cover Chapter 14, 16, 17, and 20. There's probably no way that I get to lecture on Chapter 20, unless I put something, a video online, which I may or may not do. But your study guide is abbreviated for that chapter. Okay, it doesn't include any online questions. It just includes a couple questions at the end of the chapter. So I'm going to reserve judgment as to what chapters are going to be on the final exam, but I will say not 18, but it might be 14, 16, 17, and 20. All right, but an abbreviated 20, just from the study guide. And you always want to pay attention to the study guide anyway, as knowing what to study. Okay, but I still might change that, because it's in Blackboard. Maybe right after class, I'll check. Come on. It's not. I think it's a study guide all by itself. Yeah, we'll check in Blackboard. We'll double check, make sure it's there. Okay, question. Oh, I didn't quite hear. The figures. What's ever in the study guide? There are figures in the study guide, so it's really important you know the study guide. Oh, you know, I just can't hear you guys. It sounds like I got to check the study guide for Chapter 20. Is that what it is? Check the study guide. 13. Yeah, the one that we're covering right now. Yeah. 13, 14, 16, 17, and 20. But don't forget, this is a tentative schedule. I think there's a separate study guide for 20. Okay, I'll check. I'll check in Blackboard. Okay. But I want to finish this chapter up first. Maybe after class, I'll check the study guide. Okay, so we were talking somewhere around here about heart valves. But don't forget, you should know all your heart anatomy from the prerequisite to this class. And that is, we can just kind of run over that really quick. Probably did already. How many sides does the heart have?
Two.
How many sides? That's two. And could you name them for me? Yeah, there's a left side and a right side. Okay, left ventricle pumps blood through the systemic circulation. Right ventricle pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation. So that tells you why there are two sides to the heart. Why is there a left side and a right side? Because you have two circulations. Right, you have a systemic circulation and a pulmonary circulation is why there are two sides to the heart. And when you think of the heart, you should really appreciate that it's not just one pump, but it's two pumps. It just so happens that they're kind of connected to each other and they're separated by the septum, either the interventricular septum or interatrial septum. All right, and blood flows through the heart in one direction. Okay. Oh, I want to finish up a couple other things. Okay, so now you know that the heart has two sides because there's two circulations in the body. And there are chambers inside the heart that pump blood. So how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Really good. And so there's two on the left, two on the right. Now, how many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Exactly the same number as chambers. Maybe we've done this already. That sounds really good. So here we see a nice picture of the heart. Let me get the slideshow going here. And here, so you know your anatomy really well, but I want to go over just a couple anatomical issues that will affect physiology. All right, so here we see that the atria are on top of or superior to the ventricles, And remember that myocardial tissue has branched cells that are very short. They're connected, myocardial cells are connected with intercalated discs. And in those intercalated discs, there is an electrical synapse, which means that when one cell depolarizes, the whole myocardium depolarizes because it can go through the gap junctions that make up intercalated discs. All right. Except there's one exception to that, one exceptional rule, and that is the separation between the atria and the ventricles. There's the fibrous skeleton, right? And so this is just regular connective tissue, and there are no gap junctions. So since this is connective tissue and not myocardial muscle, electrical signals can't get through the fibrous skeleton. They can't just automatically go from the atria into the ventricles. All right, so that's going to be a real important consideration. That's why I have the slide in here. Okay, but it also shows you the arrangement of the valves, and you should be aware that blood flows through the heart only in one direction because of these valves. Know their names, and of course know that there are four of them. All right, two on the right, two on the left, but there's two between the atria and the ventricles, and then there are two at the roots of the great vessels, great arteries coming off the base of the heart, like the pulmonary trunk and the aorta. Okay, but these chambers, the atria, are electrically isolated from the ventricles. And we're going to use that information in just a little bit. All right, so the heart is not like an electric pump. If you have an electric pump, you just plug it into the wall and it's pumping whatever it is, whether it's gasoline or water, continuously all the time. But the heart is not like that. The heart is what we call a reciprocating pump. That means that sometimes the heart is not contracting, but it is filling up with blood, and then part of the time the heart is contracting and is pumping that fluid out. And we refer to those with two different phases, right? So systole refers to the phase where the heart contracts, diastole refers to relaxation. And both atria contract simultaneously, followed by the ventricles, and part of that reason is because of the fibrous skeleton. It's keeping those top chambers electrically isolated from the bottom chambers. And if you look at a slide of the circulation, both the systemic and pulmonary circulation, you'll see that the systemic circulation is a lot longer than the pulmonary circulation. And so the pressure is higher in the systemic circulation. And you can measure this pressure in your arm, for instance, using a pressure cuff. The normal blood pressure in the systemic circulation is 120 over 80. And why are there two numbers right here? Because one number is the systolic pressure and the other number is the diastolic pressure. And the same thing for the right side of the heart. But since those blood vessels are very short going through the lungs, the pressure doesn't have to be the same to maintain the flow through the pulmonary system. So the pressure is a lot less. It's about 25 millimeters of mercury over 10. Right, so the pulmonary circulation does not have very high pressure in it compared to the systemic circulation. All right, let's look at some definitions for the cardiac cycle, which is systole followed by diastole followed by systole again followed by diastole. So we just went through two cardiac cycles, but you're going to have to know a lot more about that. And don't forget the sign-in sheet. It's going around someplace. Okay, so diastole, don't forget, is the relaxation phase of the heart. The end diastolic volume of blood is the amount of blood that's in the ventricle at the end of diastole, and diastole is relaxed. Okay, so during diastole, the heart fills up with blood and the ventricles expand when that happens. And systolic volume is after the heart contracts and the ventricles get really small because they're able to pump the blood out into the great arteries leaving the ventricles. And we call that the end systolic volume. So one volume is big and one volume is small. Which is the big volume? End diastolic. That's what happens, right? That's the volume right after the heart fills, right? And end systolic is the smaller. And the amount of blood that's pumped out between the end diastolic and end systolic, that's just the stroke volume. We measure these things in mLs, just like the end diastolic volume is in milliliters, right? It's all the same units. All right, so you should be able to work these little questions here. And I don't want to read this slide to you. What I want to look at is this Wiggers diagram. And in the study guide, there's a really nice one. And the one in your book is actually doing pretty, they redid that one. And that one is actually looking pretty nice. This has some additional information on it that I'm sure you will find useful. But a Wiggers diagram is a plot of some physiologic parameters versus time. Right, so those are the axes, physiologic parameters versus time. And some of the physiologic parameters will be the noises that your body makes, and in particular your heart. So this is a plot of heart sounds versus time. And also here we can measure the electrical activity. You probably are doing that this week in lab. So here's a plot of electrical activity that the heart produces versus time. So that's two important parameters. And then we have volume of the left ventricle versus time. So if we want to find out what the volume of the ventricle is during a certain part of the ECG cycle, we can just look up and actually measure that pressure by going over to the y-axis and looking up the pressure. And then the third parameter is pressure. And we see the pressure in three chambers of the heart, not all four chambers. We only see it in one of the ventricles, and this represents the pressure in the left ventricle. We're just going to confine our discussion to the left ventricle, but the right ventricle will be pretty similar, but it will just be lower pressure. So this is pressure in the left ventricle, but we also get some pressures in the atrium, okay, and also in the aorta. So this is going to be the left atrium and the aorta. All right, so let's compare these pressures. One thing that you should know is blood is a fluid, and air is a fluid, a gas is a fluid, because air is a gas, and these fluids will move according to a certain kind of energy, and that energy is pressure. Right, so, and fluids will always flow from high pressure to low pressure, sort of like, use that model in your mind for diffusion. Molecules will diffuse from high concentration to low concentration, and you could almost think of pressure as a concentration gradient if you want to get down into the physics of it. Okay, so fluids will only flow from high pressure to low pressure. They can't flow from low to high, right? If fluids can flow from low to high if there's a pump involved, which requires energy, okay? But going from high pressure to low pressure is just a passive process. What color is that?
Red.
Oh, great. Okay, microphone went off, but that's okay. You guys can hear me. Okay, so let's look at some of these parameters right here. All right, the ECG starts with this first wave that we call a P wave. This represents depolarization of the atria. And what happens then, the atria start to contract after they depolarize. And then after a certain period of time, what's the electrical phase of an action potential that comes after depolarization? It is repolarization, right? So the atria depolarize during the P wave, and then they repolarize during the QRS wave that I see right here. And then I see QRS once again, right? So that's what's happening with the atria. So let's look at the atrial pressure. So we said this P wave causes the atria to contract, and indeed, if we look at this pressure right here, notice that the pressure of the atria increases just after the P wave, because the P wave is not contraction, it's just the electrical signal to contract, and it takes a little while for the heart to contract. Okay, so the atria contract, they pump blood into the ventricles, and as the blood is leaving the atria, the pressure goes to zero in the atria. Okay, and then during the heart cycle, we see that it builds back up again, okay, levels off, and then when the atria contract, it pumps blood into the ventricles and it decreases. All right, so that's one plot. The other pressure plot we see right here is from the left ventricle. During diastole, remember that's, so you could draw in diastole over here, that's relaxation phase. During the relaxation phase, of course, then the heart is not going to produce any pressure because it's not contracting. All right, so there's very little pressure except when the atria contract. When the atria contract, it forces a little bit of blood into the ventricles and the pressure goes up minimally. You can see that little bump right there. And then there's the QRS complex. That is the signal for contraction of the ventricles. That is the depolarizing signal for the ventricles. So the other thing you can see on the ECG is that the atria get told to contract before the ventricles do. So indeed, the atria do contract together, but before the ventricles, and then both ventricles contract after the atria contract. And that makes sense because we want the atria to fill up the ventricles with blood. All right. So here we have the ventricles now starting to contract, because that's what the QRS complex is telling the ventricles to do. That's depolarization of those cells, right? And you know something about depolarization now. So the ventricles start to contract, and the pressure goes way up to 120 millimeters of mercury, and blood is being ejected from the ventricle during this period of time, from this line in this region right here. And then as blood is ejected from the heart, okay, the heart can't produce any pressure because there's nothing to push on, right? All the blood has left the heart, or some of the blood has left the heart, and so the pressure starts to decrease inside the ventricle, okay? And then the heart goes into diastole, and then there's no pressure in the ventricle when the heart is relaxing. Well, where did that blood go from a left ventricle? Okay, when it was ejected, okay, it went into the aorta, right? You're kind of familiar with that. And so the pressure in the aorta peaks up at about 180 millimeters of mercury, and then it starts to decrease all the way through diastole because the heart's not pumping anymore. And then we see another bump in pressure in the aorta when the heart contracts again, when it enters the next systole. All right, so those are the curves that we're going to look at. Oh, but we can also correlate it with a volume graph of the left ventricle. So we said that the end diastolic volume is what? The largest volume. Here I see end diastolic volume. And when is that? That's right before the heart starts to contract. All right, so here's the end diastolic volume, and then we see it's about 130 mLs. And then when the heart contracts, and it's pushing blood out of the ventricle, what happens to the volume of the ventricle? As blood is leaving, right, it's got to decrease. And it goes down to about maybe 30 milliliters. Okay, and then during diastole, what happens to the ventricle volume? It fills with blood and it expands once again. Okay, the other interesting thing is that after systole, we see that the volume of the ventricle is kind of constant, okay, at about 30 mLs, and this is what we call the end-systolic volume. And if we want to figure out how much blood was ejected from the heart, we could just subtract those two volume numbers to get what we call the stroke volume. So stroke volume is end-diastolic volume minus end-systolic volume. Okay, and I think you calculated that on the preceding slide. All right, so now we want to look at some other interesting things on this diagram. Not just, we want to correlate the opening and closing of some valves. Remember, valves are there to prevent retrograde flow of blood through the heart. And if the valves are leaky, blood can go backwards, and that eventually will kill the heart, because that's just kind of futile pumping. That would be like you running up some sand dunes all day long. Okay? What would that be like when you're running up sand dunes? You take a step up, and what happens? You slide back down, right? Take another step up, slide back down. So it takes extra effort to run up sand dunes compared to even these stairs right here. And your heart never can take a break, so that would be like you running up sand dunes all day long, and I'm sure all of us would croak if we had to do that. And your heart does too. Okay. All right, so we're interested in some valves. There are atrioventricular valves, and then there are semilunar valves. The atrioventricular valves are between the atria and the ventricles, just like the name says, and you should know tricuspid and bicuspid, where they're located. Okay, and how will blood flow? From what pressure to what pressure? From high pressure to low pressure, right? Okay, so here we see that there's greater pressure in the atrium compared to the ventricle. All right, so which way is blood going to flow? It's going to flow from the atrium because the pressure is higher into the ventricle when that happens. So, and then during diastole, this is diastole, we would expect blood to flow into the ventricles. Okay, so that makes perfect sense. And then the ventricles start to contract because the QRS complex told it that's the signal to contract, and eventually the ventricles start to contract. And I see now that the pressure is greater in the ventricles than the atria. All right, so pressure is going to want to go from where to where? From the ventricles into the aorta. It wants to do that because there's higher pressure in the ventricles. But can it go if it's a normal heart? It can't go because there's a valve there. What valve is between the atria and ventricles? Atrioventricular valve. It's going to snap closed. When blood starts to flow back into the atria, it closes so blood can't flow into the atria. And when that valve closes, it makes a noise. Okay, we call that the first heart sound. First heart sound begins right at the beginning, or you hear it right at the beginning of contraction or systole, and that's when the AV valve closes, atrioventricular valve closes, produces the first heart sound. Okay. Then the heart starts to contract. Well, at this point in time, the AV valve is closed. And let's look at the semilunar valve to find out if it's open or closed at this time. Let's look at the pressure. And where's the aortic semilunar valve located? Between the ventricle and the aorta. So we want to look at the pressure in the ventricle and the aorta to find out if that valve is open. All right, so here we have high pressure in the aorta. Let's look in this region right here. High pressure compared to the ventricle. All right, so blood is going to want to go from the aorta back into the ventricles at this point in time, exactly where I have the cursor, but can it? It can't because the semilunar valve is there. And the semilunar valve is closed when there's higher pressure in the aorta than the ventricle. Now, what about all the doorways to the ventricle during this period of time between these two lines? What did we say closes here? The AV valve closes, and during this time, the semilunar valve is also closed. And since all valves are closed, all the doorways are closed to the heart, no blood can leave the ventricle during that period of time. But it is still contracting, it's building up force, but no blood can leave because all the valves are closed. And so we call this phase isovolumetric contraction because the volume of the ventricle can't change because all the valves are closed. But the heart is contracting. And then when the pressure in the ventricle exceeds the aorta, guess what happens? Blood flows from the ventricle into the aorta. That means that the semilunar valve has to open. And indeed, that's how this diagram is labeled. Okay. And when a valve opens, if it's a normal valve, it hardly makes a sound. And so, therefore, I don't see any sound on this phonocardiogram down in the bottom line. All right. And as soon as that aortic valve opens, guess what happens to blood in the ventricle? It can start to leave through the semilunar valve into the aorta, and indeed that's what we see down on the volume graph over here. The volume of the ventricle starts to decrease. We call that the ejection phase of the ventricle, and then the heart can't pump any more blood. So here's the end systolic volume. Let's look at this top graph. Okay, when the heart starts to relax, the pressure in the ventricle gets below that of the aorta. Right, here's aortic pressure, here's ventricular pressure. So right where I have the cursor, right in this region right here, okay, how does blood want to flow? Always from high to low. And what pressure is high? The aorta is high, the ventricle is low, so blood will want to flow from the aorta into the ventricle, but can it? It can't because in a normal heart because there's a valve there. So as soon as the pressure is greater in the aorta compared to the ventricle, the aortic valve closes. All right? And they have it on this diagram right here. That's a little sloppy. I've never seen a diagram exactly perfect. All right, but you might say that this is where the semilunar valve starts to close and this is where it really is closed. Okay, and it takes a little bit of pressure from the aorta to close that valve. Some blood has to fill up those cusps, the leaflets of that valve, and so the pressure drops just a little bit in the aorta, all right, and then it goes back up to its where it would be without closing of the valve. Did you learn what this was anywhere? It's called a dicrotic notch, and so that's not an artifact, and it's supposed to be there. All right, so there's this little transient dip in blood pressure in the aorta when the semilunar valve closes because of that dicrotic notch. Okay, so the aortic valve is closed. Now, what about the AV valve? Okay, the AV valve, there's still higher pressure in the ventricles compared to the atria. So blood will want to flow from a ventricle to an atrium, but can it? It cannot because the AV valve is closed. So during this period of time, the aortic semilunar valve and the AV valve is closed. So what happens to the volume of the ventricle when all the valves are closed? It can't change. No blood can enter, no blood can leave a ventricle. So again, we call this isovolumetric, and if we look at the volume chart right here again, look, I see volume is constant. Okay, cannot change when between when the semilunar valve closes, okay, and until the AV valve opens. Okay, and when does the AV valve open? When pressure in the atria is higher than pressure in the ventricles. And when does that happen? Right here. Notice the pressure in the atria, because this is atrial pressure, and here is ventricular pressure. These, too bad I don't know what colors these things are, but you can see them, right? Should I tell you what color they are? You could tell me, and then I could tell you back. So that's okay, right? So here is the AV pressure. Here's the ventricular pressure, higher pressure in the atria compared to the ventricle. So blood will flow from the atrium into the ventricle. And in order for that to happen, the atrioventricular valve has to open, right? The AV valve has to open. So that's what these little marks mean. Okay, opens here, and AV valve closes over here. So this is isometric relaxation because all the valves to the heart are closed. And when the semilunar valve closes, let's just say it closes right at this point in time, how noisy is a valve closure? Really noisy, because the heart beats with a lot of vigor and those leaflets just snap together, all right, and that produces the second heart sound. So the second heart sound occurs at the end of systole. The first heart sound at the beginning. Okay, but you should also know what valves are closing. But for sure you got to know that a heart sound is produced by a valve that is slamming closed. Okay, so the first heart sound is due to the AV valve closing. The second heart sound is due to the semilunar valve closing on both sides of the heart. Okay, one last thing on this diagram that we see, let's go back to the electrocardiogram. And we have the first wave, which is the P wave, which is atrial depolarization. And remember, this is not contraction. This is just the signal for contraction. So that's depolarization. And what else does the atrial muscles have to go through? What do the atrial muscles have to go through after depolarization? Repolarization, and that happens at this point in time. But it also is, right at this time, the ventricles depolarize. All right, so the QRS complex is actually two signals. It is repolarization of the atria and depolarization of the ventricles, and we can't separate them out. Maybe with some fancy computer programs and some modeling and assumptions, we could separate those out, but no one ever really does. All right, so most of the signal is from depolarization of the ventricles, because what is the size of the ventricular muscle compared to the atria when you did an anatomy dissection? How thick was the wall of an atrium? Really, really thin. And how big is an atrium compared to a ventricle? It's really small, right? So the atria do not produce much of an electrical signal compared to the ventricles, especially the left ventricle, which has a really thick wall. All right, so this represents depolarization mostly of the ventricles. The signals are added together, can't see repolarization. And one way to think of that is, let's think about an everyday experience right now. Why can't you see repolarization of the atria within this signal right here? Well, if we were to walk outside and look up in the sky, and it's clear today, what about stars? Are there stars up in the sky right now? Or do they disappear during the day? Or are they there all the time? They're there all the time, but how come you can't see them during the day? Because the sun is too bright. Okay, so if you have a really large signal, like sunlight, it's going to block your view of the very dim light. Same thing with the QRS complex. You can't see repolarization of the atria because the signal from depolarization of the ventricles is just way too big. All right, but if the ventricles depolarize, what do they have to do? They've got to repolarize. And here's where they repolarize. And this is what we call the T wave. All right, so we got P, QRS, and T. So you should know where depolarization and repolarization is. And remember, these are just the electrochemical events within the heart and not the mechanical events, not contraction and not pressure. If you want to see pressure and contraction, then you have to look at these measurements up over here. And that's really the fascinating thing about a Wiggers diagram. Okay, and you know the one that's going to be on your test because that's in your study guide. Right, so there is the blank diagram, and then I also put the key in the study guide so that you can practice it I don't want to stop the PowerPoint program to show you that diagram, but it's basically just the same diagram that we went over. Okay, so you got a lub and a dub. Lub is the first sound, closing of the AV valves, the second heart sound, or the dub is closing of the semilunar valves. So you got to look at that Rigger's diagram so that you have a good appreciation of what's controlling these valves, when they open and when they close. And of course, they're very important, because if they don't work properly, then that's going to kill the heart eventually, right? If it's a big defect, it's going to kill the person right away. If it's a small defect, then it might take a little while, but eventually the heart will fail. And then what happens to the person if they have a failed heart? They die, right? So it's really important. Okay, we can get some abnormal sounds. For instance, if a valve doesn't close properly, when a ventricle contracts, some blood will squirt back up into the atria and it will make a little squirting sound, and you can hear that, or a squeaking sound. All right, and we call that a murmur. All right, so defective valves can produce murmurs. Where's that on this slide? Not on this slide. Okay. They could be congenital in origin, maybe during development in utero, the heart just didn't grow properly. Okay, that could be due to a bunch of different kinds of things. But valves can be damaged just by going through your everyday life. Any of us in here right now could end up with a damaged heart valve in a week or two if we have certain kinds of infections, like rheumatic fever. Because the bodies, the antibodies that your body produces to counteract that illness, okay, cross-reacts with heart tissue. So not only does your body produce antibodies against the streptococcus bacteria, they cross-react with valves on your heart. Okay, so you don't want that kind of infection getting systemically into your body, right? And probably you don't want it anywhere. And probably even there are some viruses that can attack heart valves, which will then make them really hard and they won't close properly. And that will cause heart murmurs, but also it will cause leaks between the different chambers. All right, and a kind of streptococcus can also produce dental caries. So when you have cavities in your teeth, that's due to bacterial action. These bacteria live underneath plaque that you have on your teeth, and when you eat food, especially sugars, those bacteria will absorb those sugars and produce an acid, and acid then just erodes the enamel of your tooth away, because the enamel just dissolves in an acid. All right, so somebody had a really nice idea. You know, we could prevent all dental caries if we inoculate people with the bacteria that produce that dental carie. We can give them a vaccine. And so, fortunately, they developed a vaccine, and they gave it to some experimental animal models first. All right, and the same thing happened in those animal models as what happens to people with rheumatic fever, is that those antibodies that are produced also attack the heart. So you can be vaccinated and never get dental caries produced by this lactobacilli bacterium, but what else are you producing antibodies to? You'll never have a dental carie, but those antibodies will also kill the heart. So of course it would never pass FDA approval as a result of that. Okay? Until somebody figures out how to make an antibody that doesn't cross-react with the heart. There's some a lot of medications that can actually do that. Oh, okay, so heart, so valves in the heart. Sometimes they don't close properly and they're leaky. Other times, valves don't open properly. And if they don't open all the way, like I can open a door to the class, I'll open it a quarter of the way. Okay, and then what about if we all want it to rush out of the room? We can't. You're going to have to kind of just squeeze through the door. And as you squeeze through the door, guess what? You make some squeezing noises, right? And blood will make some noises too if it can't get through a valve that is not opening properly. A valve that doesn't open properly is what we call stenosis. It's a stenotic valve, and if it happens to the bicuspid valve, we call that mitral stenosis, because what's another name for the bicuspid valve? Yeah, that's a mitral valve, right? And that's just the AV valve on the left side of the heart. Okay. And that accumulation of blood in the atrium can cause pulmonary hypertension. Hypertension is above normal pressure in which circulation? If there's a mitral stenosis. Okay, if there's pulmonary circulation is the right side of the heart, right through the lungs, right? And the left ventricle, as the pressure in the left ventricle builds because the mitral valve doesn't open up properly, right? Pressure builds up in the left atrium, right? Higher than pressure in the lungs, which way is blood going to want to go? From the left atrium back into the lungs when that happens. And in order to counteract that, then the right side of the heart has to pump with more pressure. The right ventricle has to pump with more pressure to overcome that, and that produces pulmonary hypertension as a result. Okay, maybe you could follow that discussion. I don't know. But maybe listen to the tape again. But use the Wiggers diagram to help appreciate, to help understand what I just said. All right, so when valves don't open properly or don't close properly, they become incompetent. Right, so an incompetent valve is a leaky valve. It could be leaky because it doesn't open or because it doesn't close properly. And it could even be due to somebody having a heart attack of the muscles that control the AV valves, and those are the papillary muscles that are attached to the chorda tendineae. Okay. Well, as you know, fetal circulation is a lot different than adult circulation. There are some modifications. And in utero, there's no really good reason for a fetus to pump blood through the lungs, but they should be pumping blood through the placenta instead. So you should appreciate the fetal circulation as doing the job of the pulmonary circulation. Okay, so blood should bypass the pulmonary circulation as a fetus. And one way that happens is that there is a passageway between the right atrium and left atrium. And what do we call a passageway in anatomy? That's called a foramen, right? And the function of a foramen is a passageway. So just think of the reverse. So blood will move from the right atrium into the left atrium, and what's it going to bypass when it does that? It's going to bypass the pulmonary circulation. So this is what we call a foramen ovale, right? Foramen is a hole in the heart. And this is normal for the fetus, but what about this hole in the heart when you're born? After you're born, is it a good idea to send blood to the lungs so that it can be oxygenated? After you're born? Sure, because you have oxygen in the air, okay? And that's why everybody in here got smacked on the butt when you were born, to help you breathe, right? To stimulate that inspiration. And so then this hole has to close so that blood goes to the lungs to pick up that oxygen. And when it closes over, it still leaves a little depression, and we call that the fossa ovalis, right? So that should ring a bell for you. And a fossa is just a depression, but it's still a complete wall, so blood can't just directly go from the right to the left atrium. Some people, it doesn't close completely. If that little hole stays open to some degree, and blood has a tendency then to squirt from the right to the left atrium, and it sometimes will make a little noise. What do we call a noise? An abnormal noise in the heart? Murmur, right? And sometimes you can pick that up on the phonocardiogram. But other times, if the hole is really small, you don't pick it up until there are really nasty changes in the heart, and then on an ECG, you can tell that the heart is failing, and then you have to do some imaging studies to find out why it is. All right, and then you can actually see blood flow from the right to the left atrium under some kinds of imaging studies. And then if you see blood flowing into the left atrium from the right, then you know that that foramen ovale is open to some degree, and that's what we call a patent foramen ovale. Patent just means that a blood vessel is open, or some tube or some kind of structure is open and blood can flow through it, and commonly we call that a PFO. All right, patent foramen ovale. If someone has a small PFO, that might not really disturb their heart until they're in their 40s, maybe even in their 50s, when their heart begins to fail. So there might be somebody even in the room that has a patent foramen ovale, and it just has to be diagnosed sooner or later. Okay, and it's closed, so then you need heart surgery to close this. And what can you imagine? To get at this little depression deep inside an atrium, would that be an easy surgery or a difficult surgery? Difficult, because what do you have to do? Where's your heart? Deep inside your thoracic cavity, so that means you have to open up the thorax, and then you got to open up another cavity. What's another cavity? The mediastinum, which contains the pericardial cavity. Then you got to open up the fibrous pericardium, open up the heart to get at this little valve right here, but this is better than have a failing heart, so it's worth it. But somebody came up with a really interesting idea, maybe about 10 years ago now, up at Stanford. Here we have the, anybody know this vessel right here? Inferior vena cava, and it's connected to what, like the, all the veins below, like what, the iliac vein, right, and the saphenous vein. These are big veins. And somebody said, well, let's just make some small, tiny tools and get a small video camera and thread them up from a vein in your leg, like the saphenous vein, into the inferior vena cava, and where is that going to go? Directly to the right atrium, and then we can work on this PFO without cracking somebody's chest open, without opening up their mediastinum. And that's a really popular surgery right now, and you're probably back at work almost the very next day, okay, even having, because it's not open heart surgery anymore. So that's pretty interesting. Okay, electrical activity of the heart. Myocardial cells are short, they're branched, they're interconnected with gap junctions, there are electrical synapses between the cells, so if one myocardial cell depolarizes, that depolarization goes from one cell to another, not only from right to left, but because they're branched, it also goes from top to bottom, it goes through the whole wall thickness. And after those cells depolarize, what do? They repolarize, but I was thinking of something else. After depolarization, what happens to them? They start to contract. Okay, so that depolarization is the signal for contraction, but not exactly the same. All right, so action potentials are transmitted to all cells via those gap junctions, but the atria are separated from the ventricles. What separates the atria from the ventricles that prevents that electrical signal from going from the atria into the ventricles? The fibrous skeleton, because that's just connective tissue. It's not myocardial muscle. Connective tissue doesn't have gap junctions. As a matter of fact, as far as I know, it doesn't even have any kind of chemical synapses, right? Okay, so the atria and ventricles are isolated from each other because of the fibrous skeleton. So that means that the atria contract first. That helps load up the ventricles with blood. Then the ventricles contract. So both atria contract together, and then both ventricles contract. So how is that coordinated? At least in the normal heart, that's how it goes. Okay. So there are some special myocardial cells that automatically depolarize by themselves. They do not need a signal from a neuron to do that. They have just spontaneous depolarization, and when these cells reach a certain level, then an action potential will begin. What is that certain level called? Threshold voltage, right? So some of these cells will automatically depolarize, and when it reaches threshold, then there's an action potential. Action potential will flow through both atria, causing what? Depolarization and contraction, but it can't get through into the ventricles, except there is a special pathway. Okay, here is a special pathway made up of muscle cells, but they don't contract. But muscle cells, can a muscle cell conduct action potentials? Sure, because they have voltage-gated channels, right? And that's the whole function of those T-tubules, so that an action potential can go down deep inside of a muscle fiber. All right, so these are specialized muscle fibers then that get an action potential from the atria. This little node right here is called the atrioventricular node, because it's right between the atrium and the ventricles and that fibrous skeleton. These things depolarize, but they depolarize very slowly. So this acts as a delay of sending the signal into the ventricles. And then the signal does go through the fibrous skeleton, through the bundle of His, or the atrioventricular bundle, and it enters the septum. There are other kinds of conducting cells in the septum, okay, that we call bundle branches. And an action potential will travel very rapidly through a bundle branch, down to the apex of the heart, and then out through some Purkinje fibers, and then depolarization will spread through both ventricles and the septum, causing what? The ventricles to contract. Okay, so an action potential is started at the pacemaker of the heart, and we call that the sinoatrial node. This is the part of the heart that will spontaneously depolarize the fastest. And since it depolarizes the fastest, it controls the heart rate of the whole heart, because the whole heart is connected together with gap junctions. So that's why we call this the pacemaker. And then an action potential will move over both atria, finally into the AV node. Remember, an action potential in this AV node is really slow to develop, so that allows the atria to contract. The AV valves are open. That pumps a little bit more blood into the ventricles. And then an action potential zips down through the bundle branches, okay, to the Purkinje fibers. And the part of the ventricles that actually contract first are these apical regions. So the apical regions contract, right, and then it moves up more to the basal region of the heart, and finally the basal region of the heart contracts. But what happens when the apical regions contract first? It helps squish blood superiorly and then out through the semilunar valve. So we don't want the basal regions of the heart to contract first and then the apical, because that would force blood down into the apex. It does not happen that way because of the conduction system. So you got to remember the conduction system of the heart. That's from anatomy. Okay, so you got to know your SA node and AV node, okay, bundle branches, bundle His, Purkinje fibers, okay. And every once in a while, somebody could have a heart attack. Blood flow to some part of the heart will be obstructed, and it will kill that part of the heart. It will cause an infarction. And somebody could have a heart attack right in this region right here, right at the junction between the atria and ventricles, and kill these cells right here. What you think could happen, what happens now when these cells are dead? Can a dead cell transmit an action potential? Cannot. So now, the action potential started by the SA node is trapped within the atria, never gets into the ventricles. And of course, that seems really, really dangerous, but it's not really too bad for the following reason. And that is because all myocardial cells have an auto rhythm, they depolarize. It's just that these in the ventricles depolarize at a slower rate, rhythmically. So the atria will contract with one rhythm, and the ventricles will contract at another rhythm, which is slower. All right, and so that really saves the life of that person. Okay, and that can be diagnosed. How would you diagnose, okay, differences or abnormalities in depolarization of the heart? What kind of measurement would you use? Yeah, electrocardiogram to do that. And it's really obvious on an electrocardiogram, for instance, if there's an infarct in this part of the heart. Okay. So what does a nodal cell look like in terms of depolarization? Here is a plot of voltage versus time. Dang, we're just having too much fun with all this information. Okay. So here we can see a plot of voltage versus time from a nodal cell in the heart. Not a contractile cell, but a nodal cell. Right, so a nodal cell is not specialized for contraction. It's specialized for transmitting action potentials throughout the heart. Right, and we said that all heart cells automatically do what? Here is resting membrane potential. And is this cell at rest? It's really never at rest. Okay, it starts to depolarize immediately because of these HCN channels. Okay, and this HCN channel allows sodium to enter the cell. What does sodium do? It causes depolarization. All right, so these channels are open all the time. And then when it reaches threshold, guess what happens? Depolarization, because voltage-gated calcium channels open up. Okay, and so it's not really due to sodium like we see in a skeletal muscle cell or a nerve cell. Okay, this depolarization is caused by calcium inside the cell. All right, so where would you like to have proper calcium levels? Inside your heart so that it depolarizes properly, or your bones? Definitely the heart, right? So again, right, you got to remember, you got to protect yourself from osteoporosis. Well, how do you do that? Okay, diet and exercise. Two reasons why people hate physiology. Okay, you got to stress those bones to make them strong, to get big. All right, so then, okay, that causes massive depolarization and the potassium channels open, and you're familiar with that. What do we call that? Repolarization back down to resting membrane potential. But don't forget, there are leaky sodium channels that cause depolarization again to threshold, and that causes another action potential. And at every action potential right here, what eventually happens? Because of excitation-contraction coupling, the myocardial cells start to contract and pump blood. But they need this action potential as a signal to do that. All right, and since they just automatically depolarize, right, it controls the rhythm of the heart, the heartbeat. Okay. Other tissues in the heart are spontaneously active. They depolarize, but it's a slower depolarization. So another part of the heart will depolarize, but the slope won't be so great. So when does it reach threshold? At a much longer time. So it will beat at a slower rate as a result of that. Okay. So if there is a blockage at the AV node or a bundle branch, okay, then the atria have its normal pacemaker. What's the normal pacemaker of the heart? The SA node. Okay, and that signal can't get into the ventricles, so another pacemaker develops inside the ventricles that controls the ventricles. We call that an ectopic pacemaker. So now your heart has two pacemakers. One is at the normal location, the SA node. The other is in an abnormal location that we call an ectopic pacemaker. Okay. So, and that happens if action potentials are prevented from getting into the ventricles. Okay, myocardial cells have a resting membrane potential of about minus 90 millivolts. They depolarize to threshold by action potentials originating in the SA node. So if there's an action potential in the SA node, how does that action potential get to all of the muscle cells within an atrium or both atria? How does an action potential spread from one cell to another throughout both ventricles because they're a syncytium? Because between the cells they have gap junctions, which allow sodium to enter the neighboring cells, which causes depolarization. And if that reaches threshold, then of course there's an action potential that ensues from that. Okay, so here's another kind of action potential. You've seen a couple different kinds of action potentials already. You had to draw out in lab, I think, an action potential produced by a neuron. Okay, you just saw action potential produced by nodal cells. Looks like this. This looks pretty similar to a neuron action potential, except the neuron doesn't automatically depolarize. Here is an action potential in a contractile cell. This is no longer a nodal tissue, but this is from a contractile cell, a muscle that actually produces tension and pressure with inside the heart. So here we have resting membrane potential, okay, about minus 90 millivolts, and this is a signal versus time. So this is a voltage measurement versus time. And does this represent pressure or contraction? You know what? It only represents voltage. Okay, so it doesn't represent anything mechanical that the heart is doing. This is just the electrical signal that will initiate contraction. So there's a very rapid depolarization, super rapid compared to a nodal cell. Okay, and that's due to voltage-gated sodium channels. Once they reach threshold, they depolarize, and that opens more sodium channels because they're voltage-gated, which then opens more sodium channels and it depolarizes. So that's a little positive feedback mechanism in here. All right, and then what usually happens after depolarization? Repolarization. But you get that immediate repolarization in a contractile cell of the heart. You do not, because there are calcium channels that open up on myocardial cells, and calcium will then start to enter the myocardial cell. And what does that do for the myocardial cell? When a cation enters a cell, what do we call that? When a cation enters a cell. What about sodium? Is sodium a cation? Indeed it does. It does the same thing. It causes depolarization, right? So these calcium channels move into the cell that maintains depolarization, maintains that cell in a depolarized state. This is what we call the plateau region of an action potential from a contractile cell in the heart. Okay, and then finally those calcium channels close and these potassium channels kind of win out, and the myocardium then can, due to these potassium channels, can do what? Repolarize. Okay. All right, so remember though that in order to reset these sodium channels, you have to get back down to resting membrane potential because there's a refractory period. What cannot happen during a refractory period? An action potential cannot be initiated again, and if a muscle cell can't be stimulated with an action potential, what can it not do? It cannot contract again. Okay? So what's really fortunate is that a myocardial cell can't go into tetanus like a skeletal muscle can because it has these kinds of action potentials. Right? And I'm sure everybody has had a muscle cramp. Okay, walking down the sidewalk, sleeping in bed, doing something like that. But none of you have had a muscle cramp in your what? In your myocardium or your heart. Because what would happen? Well, you wouldn't be here in class, right? you'd go unconscious in 2 seconds, and then you'd be brain dead in 2 to 3 minutes, right? So this protects the heart from going into tetanus. And we would say the plateau phase of the action potential of those contractile cells prevents tetany in the heart, which I'm sure you can realize is a really beneficial thing. Okay, so I don't think I need to go over this slide again. Okay, because I did already. All right, this is just kind of a review from anatomy. Action potentials and the SA node travel at about 1 meter per second. And what did I say about the AV node? Really slow, right? 0.03, 0.05 meters per second. So the AV node slows down action potential so that the atria can contract first, followed by the ventricles, right? And then down, the speed increases again, back up really fast, okay? So that the apical regions of the heart contracts. We looked about excitation-contraction coupling already in skeletal muscle and the heart, so we're familiar with this. And is the heart striated or not striated? Myocardial muscle. It's striated. So what's the building block that allows for contraction in the myocardium or the heart? A sarcomere, just like in skeletal muscle, right? So there's troponin and tropomyosin. Cross bridges form when there's calcium flooding through the myofibrils that produce all those sarcomeres. Okay, so here now is an interesting plot that shows, again, voltage versus time. And can you recognize what kind of cell are we looking at? Here's the action potential. Does this look like a neuron? No, it doesn't. Wow, you guys are freaking me out. You know this is not a neuron. That's great. Okay, is it a nodal tissue? No, it is what? Contractile tissue with inside the heart, because why? This plateau region right here, right? That's a dead giveaway that it's a contractile cell inside the heart and not even a skeletal muscle. And you got to remember what kind of channels are producing the plateau region? A calcium channel, okay? So the heart depolarizes, and then after depolarization, what happens? The muscle starts to contract. So this is sort of an interesting diagram because we have one vertical axis that shows us millivolts, but this plot right here is not electrical activity of the heart. This is an actual mechanical event within inside the heart. So what happens first? Does the heart contract first, or does it get the electrical signal first? Yeah, the electrical signal precedes contraction, and we can see exactly what happens. So remember, those sodium channels have an inactivation gate. As soon as when it reaches plus 20 millivolts, that inactivation gate of the sodium channel closes, which then prevents depolarization again, except those calcium channels open that maintain depolarization. That signals the muscle to contract, okay, and those sodium, the inactivation gates are still closed, okay, until you can reach resting membrane potential at this point in time. So because another action potential can't ensue during this period of time, right, you have these two refractory periods. All right, so this just shows you with the same time scale, right, contraction of that particular cell versus the electrical activity so that you can see these refractory periods. Okay, so what does that prevent? That extra long refractory period due to the plateau region, it prevents the heart from going into tetanus, okay, or going into what we call a cramp, okay, which of course you know which would be really, really bad. Now, when you get a cramp in the skeletal muscle, like your toe or your leg or your arm or whatever, how does it feel? Very painful, yeah. And guess what would happen if your heart went into a big cramp like that? It would be painful as well. Okay, so sometimes heart attacks are really, really painful. A heart attack is not when the myocardium goes into contraction. It's just when you cut off blood supply to it. Okay, and that's what's happening to a cramping muscle that you have. Hurts really bad. So here is just a superposition of action potential from a contractile cell justified with this normal ECG, and we see depolarization of the ventricle, because this is a ventricular cell right here, produces what? The QRS complex. This plateau phase, there's no change in voltage, so we can't measure it on the ECG. And then when these myocardial cells repolarize, that produces the T wave. Right? So that just shows you from one cell to what we can measure on the surface of the body. And this is really a nice large voltage because, right, there are millions and millions of cells undergoing this depolarization, repolarization at one time. Okay, so ECG and EKG are exactly the same. I think I talked about all this stuff already. Okay, so you can fill that out. This is a nice little slide that shows how that wave of depolarization moves through the heart. Starts where? At the SA node, and then flows over both atria. Okay, and then the AV node holds that signal for a little bit. Okay, and then it enters the ventricles. Okay, and it causes depolarization of the apical regions first before the basal regions, that forces blood up through the arteries at the base of the heart. Okay, and then the ventricles repolarize. All right, so that's pretty good. Here's that Wiggers diagram. Went over that already, which with a much better diagram because we had atrial pressure in there as well as ventricular volume. Okay, so we're done with the cardiovascular parts. Structure of blood vessels. All right, let's answer some of these questions pretty quick. We might take some time to do that. Material can enter or leave the blood only through what kind of vessel? Capillaries, they're specialized for exchange, and you should know why that is. What structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? This is a blast from the past. I didn't talk about it in here, but in anatomy, it's called the precapillary sphincter. It's a circular smooth muscle right at the entrance to a capillary, and when it contracts, that particular vessel closes. Name two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. Okay, because the pressure in a vein is very low. And how will a fluid flow? From high pressure to low, and if the pressure in a vein is almost the same in the atria, then there'll be very little flow from veins back up into the atria. So your body has two other pumps that can help get venous blood back into an atrium. We talk about that in anatomy too. It's called the respiratory pump and the skeletal muscle pump. Right, whenever you contract the muscle, that pressurizes that vein, so the blood pressure in that vein in your arm increases, and it's going to want to squirt to the heart, and it also wants to squirt back down to your hand. Why can't venous blood in your arm go back down to your hand? Because there are valves in veins that prevent that retrograde flow of blood. So veins and lymphatic vessels in the heart have valves to prevent that retrograde flow of blood. Oh, that was the next question. Name three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. I'm not going to say it again, but you can listen to the tape. Which layer is responsible for forming valves? In the heart as well as in lymphatic vessels and veins. It is the endothelium. Endothelium. What's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? Ah, that's a pretty good question. I'm glad I thought of that. What is a sphincter? A sphincter is, it has a certain shape. What kind of shape? It's circular, right? So it's sort of like an orbicularis muscle, but it's under automatic control, involuntary control. What muscle is involuntarily controlled? Smooth muscle, okay? And heart muscle too, but smooth muscle in particular I'm thinking of. All right, so sphincter is a circular smooth muscle that's under autonomic control or local control. And so in order for a sphincter to do its job, that muscle has to contract. And when a muscle contracts, what's a prerequisite for that contraction? What does a muscle need in order for it to contract? Okay? It's an active process. It needs, I didn't hear you say that, but maybe somebody said ATP, right? So a sphincter requires ATP to open or close that sphincter. Now what about a valve, a heart valve, or a valve in a blood vessel? Does not need ATP. It just needs a pressure difference. Right? It just needs a pressure gradient, and those valves will work automatically because of that pressure gradient. So that's a big difference between a sphincter and a valve. Sphincter is a muscle. A valve is just endothelium and some connective tissue. Okay, structure of blood vessels. We looked at that already. Oh, here's that precapillary sphincter. All right, so here's an artery. Arteries, so blood is coming from a large artery then into smaller arteries. We call this a bifurcation, right? So blood enters this arteriole and might enter this capillary bed. But here is a precapillary sphincter, smooth muscle, right, that can constrict and that will decrease blood flow, or it can dilate, allowing blood flow into this capillary network. right? And then blood then will come back together because these veins will join together. We don't call that a bifurcation. We call that an anastomosis, okay? When smaller vessels join together to make a bigger vessel, and you just have to think of the direction of the blood flow. Okay, because of these precapillary sphincters right here and smooth muscle around arterioles, changing the diameter of an arteriole and this precapillary sphincter, that's what produces most of the resistance in your cardiovascular system, which then produces the greatest drop in blood pressure, are these small blood vessels, because they have smooth muscles around them. Okay. And capillaries, because they're so small, they have a large surface area. And when you think of surface area, what's the physiologic thought you should have? Exchange, right? Okay. The state of the precapillary sphincters. You should know from anatomy three kinds of capillaries, right? There's a very leaky capillary. There's one that's not so leaky, and there's one in between. Does anybody know the leakiest kind of capillary? It has holes in it. They're called the discontinuous capillaries, right? They're in the liver and spleen, so even red blood cells can leave those blood vessels, and then they got to find their way back in. Okay, fenestrated have little small pores in them, so these are pretty leaky, and most of the capillaries in your body are continuous capillaries. So maybe your book has some pictures of those, but your anatomy book does. Okay, this is important for physiology. Okay, because the kidneys have these fenestrated capillaries. And we're probably going to end up talking about a process called filtration, a special process that happens in the kidneys because they have fenestrated capillaries. Okay, veins contain the majority of blood. They're very compliant. That means they expand very easily. I want to go over that in just a second. And they contain very low blood pressure. So blood is not really motivated to leave a vein unless there's a muscle near it that's contracting or unless you breathe. Okay? So why does air flow into your lungs? How does a fluid flow again? From high pressure to low pressure. So there's relatively constant, there's constant pressure in the atmosphere. So in order to get air to go into your lungs, guess what we have to do to the pressure inside our lungs? Got to make it lower than atmospheric pressure. So we got to turn our lungs into a vacuum cleaner that's going to suck air in. But it doesn't only just suck air into the thoracic cavity. What else is it sucking in? It's sucking in blood from your extremities. And so we call that the respiratory pump. Every time you expand your chest volume, that creates that vacuum cleaner, and it sucks air into your lungs, but also helps suck blood into the thoracic cavity. And why doesn't that blood that gets sucked to your heart go back out to your extremities? When you exhale, we're forcing air out of our lungs, we're pressurizing our chest, air is leaving, but how come blood doesn't leave? Because what does a vein have? It has valves, right? So the respiratory pump works for that reason. Here's an example of that skeletal muscle pump, okay? When these muscles contract, it pressurizes this region right here, blood can't squirt back down to the periphery, it only goes to the heart, and that's it for this chapter. Okay, so next time we're going to start with cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure. And that's a really important, all these chapters are really important.